You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Ruth Padel. She's talking to me from London. Ruth, thanks so much for being with me today.
Hi, Brainerd. Lovely to be here.
Ruth, let's talk about what you're working on now. I know you're going to ask you to read from a few things, but what is it that you're currently involved in, currently writing?
Okay, well, I'm just finishing or editing with my editor a book called Emerald. It's a collection of poems, and it started out as I just got terribly interested in emerald. And, you know, I went to the New York Museum of Natural
Museum of Natural History.
There's this wonderful emerald growing out of the rock, and it's so amazing that rock grows, and then it becomes a crystal. And, you know, why do people see their fortune in crystals? This is a stone with light in it, or you can see different things in it from different perspectives. And why have people always thought that emeralds were magic and of healing? And the whole idea of green coming that is found in the dark and the symbol of spring under the earth. So that got all sort of washed over when my mother died, you know, this year in February. She was 97. And she'd been, you know, she beat us at a sort of word game 3-4 days before she died, my daughter and me. She'd been very on the ball. You know, if your mother's been around for so long, it's very, very strange. Well, it's losing your mother is hard anyway. And the Afghan vegetable seller, down the road, he said to me when I said, how are you? And I said, well, actually, my mom's just died. And he said, ah, mother is love. And I thought, yeah, that's what you feel. So I suppose all of that was kind of looped into the ideas about and crystallizing.
What was the word he said? Mother is
love.
Mother is love. Yeah.
Love. L-O-V-E. He was, and it was just such a simple thing to say. Mother is love, and it just came straight from the heart. Here's this boy who came from Afghanistan. God knows what his journey was. Working here in London, and that's the first thing he said. So I could read you a little bit. I opened this collection with a poem about the Emerald Tablet, which was the founding text of alchemy and also Jungian psychoanalysis. And I was talking about it with a friend in New York in the Morgan Library, and he reminded me of the ending of Gilgamesh. And sometimes all crystallized into a poem about the Emerald Tablet. So I could read a bit of that. Shall I try that?
Yes, I'd love that.
Okay. So this is new, so I haven't read it before, so I don't know how it's going to come out. The Emerald Tablet. This is to do with lostness. We're believing that the truth is buried in some special place, difficult to find. And some hero of ancient wisdom, Moses, Borges, Gandalf, the stern, kind, omniscient, oracle-giving grandfather you never had, will pop out of the green, out of the woodwork, to rescue and reveal it to you. It will start by saying, above, same as below. Meaning, I think, our loneliness is not alone. And we'll go on to say that spirit, your own spirit, but also universal energy which controls if you feel you belong, is not trying to split away from atoms of your body, as we are told the Christians say. It is embedded in nature, and you, yourself, are the crucible in which this metal can be turned gold. This is to do with transformation, to do with set where they are in you once they are gone. It's just the beginning, but it's a long poem, that one. And there's one little one right at the end, because I'm thinking, of course, emeralds come in every sort of way. They come in raw crystal, and they come, and you know, Colombian mines. They also, of course, have rings and jewelry and that sort of thing. And they're more valuable than diamonds, weight for weight, apparently, because they're so much more difficult to find. But here's this one right at the end. It's called Set in Gold. And I have the sort of the actual death right at the end, the sort of underworldy thing. Set in gold. This is death. Note. Gentlest it could. She was 97. Had to happen. She was shatterproof. Her last word after, where am I? When we were said we were all here with her, was encouraging us, great. And Pluto took her, Lord of the Underworld, the only god sworn to tell the truth. Hmm. Well, you've got the first poem and the last poem.
And this is from the forthcoming book that should be out when, next year?
Yeah, in July.
Thank you for reading those. Ruth, let's talk about some of your other work. I know you have a few other things that I asked you to read. So perhaps from an older work now, past book, either... What would you like to read?
Well, maybe I might... I wrote about the only novel I've written so far, although there are more on the horizon. It's called Where the Serpent Lives. And it's about wildlife zoologists in India, and you know the front line of defenders of the wild, really, which are whom I met a lot in India. And it starts with a scientist trying to measure something in the nest of a king cobra. I'll just read a little bit of that, but it's about the sort of meeting with one of the laws of life, really, of this sort of king cobra, which is the longest venomous snake, very beautiful. Rainforest in the dry season. If you looked closely at those black zigzag lines under green bamboo, you would see they were not the shadow of overlapping leaves, but edges between the charcoal grey scales of her head. You could have admired the bronze shadows of each honey flame iris, the pearl pale ring encircling each black pupil, and maybe have seen the whole of her, a dark knot on a double-decked mound of dead bamboo leaves, high as a man's thigh. The only movement was a luminous ant exploring the underside of a leaf, and a few months, like red full dots, sampling her interstitial skin. So then I introduce a protagonist, a human protagonist called Richard, and he's bending down because the snake has glided away to have a drink. He began slowly to straighten, but above him came a low, roaring growl, and he froze. He was one of the few people in the world who knew what that growl was. King cobras do not hiss like other snakes. They expel air through holes in the trachea. Now he saw the hood towering above him, her golden throat, black-edged like a morning card, with 2 feet from his nose. She must have been rearing up to see over the bushes, and he'd alarmed her by standing up himself. In that electric moment, when human meets king cobra, I, each is liable to confuse the other's motives. Keep still, he thought. Be very still. He knew the biology all too well. She could force into his tissues 0.7 milliliters of citron-tinged venom, enough to kill an elephant or 20 people. Running was hopeless. he'd still be in her range 6 feet away, and she could charge amazingly fast. No eye contact. Let her gaze. She would do what she decided. The forest was utterly still, but for the thud of his still healthy heart. The leech, wriggling over his shoe, might be surprised in a minute by what was happening to the blood it was so keen to reach. Every snake venom is a unique cocktail of enzymes, polypeptides, and glycoproteins, which act on different systems of the body, nerves, breath, muscles, blood. Neurotoxin, the main component in cobra venom, would bind instantly to receptors on the surface of his muscle cells, block communication between his nerves and muscle, severing the impulses that made his muscles contract. Meanwhile, tissues round the bite would swell and necrotize. Hemorrhaging would crumble his capillaries, and his own blood would circulate to the rest of his body, the proteins causing all this havoc. The minutes those neurotoxins would stun his nervous system, slow his breathing, paralysis would follow, as the textbooks said, very fast. Looking down at his feet, like a boy confessing to a broken rule, Richard stood immobile for what seemed a very long time. He concentrated, as only a scientist or a poet can, on precise names for the leaves he was looking at. He felt her eyes upon him. He was in the hands of the living god, of neurosynapses in a reptile brain. When he looked up, she was gone.
So lovely, and again, exciting and terrifying.
Can you hear me okay?
It sounds good.
Okay. So that partnering, working on wildlife and all the stuff I do for wildlife, I wrote a memoir of tiger conservation, and I've been a fellow of the Zoological Society of London and worked with a WCS, Wildlife Conservation Society, scientist in South India. A lot of that has come out of my work on Darwin, because I happened to be one of the many great-great-grandchildren of Charles Darwin. And I wrote this book, which Knopf published in 2009, called Darwin, A Life in Poems, in which I really was using his diaries, his journals, his letters, as well as his published work, to sort of give a kind of biography of him out of his thought over, you know, from boyhood to when he died. So I thought one poem I might read from that. It's a poem. He's just 22. He's just started his great beagle voyage. He doesn't know what on earth he's going into. And he's just left Brazil. And he's hated Brazil. I mean, he loved the jungles and the wildlife, but he hated the slave markets, the slave culture. When he left Brazil, he said, I thank God I will never be a slave country again. And then he saw phosphorus on the sea. And in his journal, he wrote, this is just like Milton. He loved Paradise Lost. And so this is just called Remembering Milton in the Night at Sea. The night, pitch dark. The whole sea, luminous. Every part of water, which by day is seen as foam, glowed with pale light. The vessel drove before her bows two billows of liquid phosphorus. Her wake was a milky train. As far as the eye reached, the crest of every wave was bright. And from the reflected light, the sky, just above horizon, not so utterly dark as the rest of the heavens. Impossible to behold this plane of matter, as it were melted and consumed by heat, without remembering Milton. And I think, I looked up the passage of Paradise Lost he must have been thinking of, and it's when Satan is summoning in book one all the hosts of the evil ones to join him. And Milton says, through the gloom were seen 10,000 banners rise into the air with orient colors waving. I think you must have been thinking of something like that, the light through the darkness that posts for us, you know, which is the same as Lucifer, the light bringer.
The phosphorus, you said.
Yeah, phosphorus, yeah. Phosphorus means light bringing, just like Lucifer. Yeah.
I didn't know that was Latin and Greek.
Yeah, sure. The same word, really, from Latin and Greek. It's weird, isn't it? But the devil is the one who brings the light as well as the darkness.
It is. You wouldn't expect that to be translated that way. That's why it stopped you. That seems so odd. It seemed wrong, as the devil as the bringer of the light. It seems an odd way to think about it. But you can't really bring darkness either. It's kind of an odd thing to bring. You know,
that's true. Yeah. But I love this image of this 22-year-old young man who had no idea he was going to change the world. You know, there he is on his little ship, or somebody else's little ship, leaving Brazil, having been absolutely overwhelmed by 4 months of sort of looking at wildlife and geology and all the rest of it, but hating the slave culture, going off further around South America, and then just seeing this dark sea and the light in it.
Yeah, it must have been extraordinary. Gosh. And your interest in speaking of him and all of this that you've read so far and some of your activities involving, you know, animals and geology and the culture of wildlife, there's relationships to Darwin. And I know you said, like many, you're a great, great grandchild, but this seems to have a central kind of force in your life, this relationship to all the societies you belong in and the kind of natural world. I don't know how to sum it up, but a number of things that you continue to be involved in. And so I guess my question is, is that the case, and where did that interest come from? Is that something you've always consciously nurtured, or that's always what you were drawn to? Because it does seem to be an affinity to that kind of Darwinian, you know, mind or moving about in the world.
Well, it's a very good question. It's a very perceptive question. Yeah, it came upon me gradually, and it really came through my mother and her mother, because her mother was Darwin's granddaughter, Nora Barlow. She was Nora Darwin, and then she became Nora Barlow. And she edited a lot of... She was my grandmother, and she edited a lot of his work, a lot of his Darwin Voyage, the Beagle Diary, and also his letters and his autobiography. And I was very close to my granny. And so, I talked to her a lot about Darwin. But also, both she and my mother, they always, you know, we were always taught excitedly to look at nature and wonder about it, to turn the leaf underside, to look through the binoculars at the birds, to wonder about why that animal is behaving like that. And I think that's where it comes from. And when I first set foot in a tiger forest when I was doing my tiger book, I felt at home in a very strange way, and I think it was to do with home, about writing. I loved, you know, the Jungle Book, and I used to know the poems in it by heart when I was little, just because I loved them. And this sense of being in a forest where there are tigers, and you're pretty certain not to see one, but you know they're there, and they are connected to every single leaf you see, every small snake or mongoose or bird in some way or other. And it's rather like the meaning in a poem or a text. You may not ever see the meaning, but you know it's there, and it's giving life to the whole thing. And it, somehow, it's connected with writing.
That's fascinating. Yeah, and it's, well, perhaps I should ask you to read something else before I keep going on about it. But it's
okay.
Yeah.
I'll read something very different now. This is the title poem of a book called Learning to Make an Oud in Nazareth. An oud, O-U-D, is is a musical, an Arabic musical instrument, and they were made about the sort of 7th, 8th century AD, and it's the origin of the lute. You know, it was El Oud became lute when the Crusaders came back from the Holy Land, having wrought their destruction. They brought with them this wonderful instrument, this stringed instrument, which they played as the origin of the guitar, which they called lute, from El Oud. But in the Arab world now, the most famous and most played instrument is the oud. And this poem was in the New Yorker. It was it arose from listening to three oud players who were born in Nazareth. A trio called the Trio Gibran, and also a tour of poetry I did in Palestine and Israel. Learning to make an oud in Nazareth. Oh, perhaps I ought to say that it uses the Song of Songs, so it's braiding the Song of Songs, the Song of Solomon, in through the poem. But it also, I suppose, somebody pointed out, it didn't occur to me before, but it's a kind of little creation myth, mini creation myth in some sort of way, a creation and destruction and survival myth. Learning to make an oud in Nazareth. The first day, he cut rosewood for the back, bent sycamore into ribs, and made a belly of mahogany. Let us go early to the vineyards and see if the vines have budded. The sky was blue over the Jezreel Valley, and the gilt dove shone above the church of the Annunciation. The second day, he carved a camel bone base for the fingerboard. I sat down under his shadow with the light. The third day, he made a nut of sandalwood and a pickguard of black cherry. He damascened a rose of horn with arabesques lustrous as underleaves of olive beside the sea. I have found him whom my soul loves. He inlaid the sound hole with ivory swans, each pair a valentine of entangled necks, and fitted tuning pegs of apricot to give a good smell when rubbed. The fourth was a day for cutting high strings of camel gut. His left hand shall be under my head. For the lower course, he twisted copper, pale as tarmac under frost. He shall lie all night between my breasts. The fifth day, he laid down varnish. Our couch is green, and the beams of our house are cedar and pine. Behind the neck, he put a sign to keep off the evil eye. My beloved is a cluster of campfire in the vineyards of En-Gedi, and I watched him whittle an eagle's feather, a plectrum, to celebrate the angel of improvisation who dwells in clefts on the Nazareth ridge, where love waits and grows if you give it time. Set me as a seal upon your heart. On the sixth day, the soldiers came for his genetic code. We have no record of what happened. I was queuing at the checkpoint to Galilee. I sought him and found him not. He'd have been in his open-air workshop. I called, but he gave me no answer. The self-same spot where Jesus stood when he came from Capernaum to teach in synagogue, and townsfolk tried to throw him from the rocks. Until the day break and shadows flee away, I will get me to the mountain of Myrrh. The seventh day, we set his wounded hands around the splinters. Come with me from Lebanon, my spouse. Look from the top of Shemir and Harmon, from the lion's den. On the eighth, there were no more days. I took a class in carpentry and put away the bridal rug. We started over with a child's oud bought on eBay. He was a virtuoso of the oud, and his banner over me was love. So that's the opening of a collection which hasn't been published in the States. It was shortlisted for the Elliott Prize here. But it has sort of harmony in the idea of music at its center. So it brings together Christian, Judaism, and Islam in the Holy Land and looks at the rift in the lute, really, the rift in the Holy Land, with the geological rift and all sorts of other rifts, and talks about conflict within the human psyche.
It's a wonderful collection and idea, and the idea of what you just said, it sounds, you know, Judaism and Christianity and Islam and all the rifts, and trying to just even look at that and write about it. I mean, as you have done in what you just read so beautifully, seems like the most monumental task I can think of. I can't think of anything more complex than, as you're saying, that region is, you know, religiously, philosophically, and in so many ways. It seems like such a challenge to take on, is what I'm saying. What an ambitious thing to do. It seems almost impossible, doesn't it?
Well, thank you. Well, I'm glad you asked. I didn't set out to do it. You know, it grew incrementally. The first poem that I wrote from that collection over 12 years was actually about the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem during the time that there was the Israeli siege of it. I remember, it was Easter 2002, and I started from the utter disconnect of the place at the moment of the holiest moment of the Christian year at Easter. And the Church of the Nativity, the first church in the world, being besieged by tanks. And, you know, what were Christians in the world doing about it? It was an extraordinary moment. It lasted for a long time. Mm. And I could only get through it. I'm not, you know, I'm probably spiritual rather than religious. It was, my father was a psychoanalyst, and of course I've got Darwin, great-great-grandfather. So having Darwin on one side and Freud on the other shoulder is a sort of complication, but it doesn't fight with religion.
Well, I would think in one way it allows you to look at it, because it's, you know, to observe it from that point of view, to observe religion and so much that it contains, because the problem, I think, in often writing or talking about different religions or viewpoints is the writer's upbringing and childhood, because these are, you know, part of our being. I wasn't raised in a religious way, so I feel like I can look at things with a little less passion or emotion, or something maybe deeper than that, or not that it's deeper, but something that's harder to unwind. Do you know what I mean? As opposed to, it sounds like the mentors, the family that you've had, that in a Darwin-esque way allowed for this type of observation.
Maybe that's true. But I've lived a lot in Greece, particularly in Crete, and I find myself, you know, that's where I get close to one sort of part of another part of feeling in contact with things. And whenever I go into a little Greek church on a mountain, I normally light a candle and pray, I guess. I thought maybe you would look in my book on migration, which is a sort of mixture of little essays and then poems, the runs of poems, which is about animals migrating and cells migrating, and then people, the history of people migrating, and then souls, the idea of the migration of souls, then goes from self to soul, really. But I have sort of various ones in Greece, and this is just a little one for two friends who have both passed away now, but they were both born in the diaspora, in the Greek diaspora, and they were both early teenagers when the Germans invaded Greece and invaded Europe, and they fled back to Greece. because Greece was at home, and they went to their ancestral islands, each of their ancestral islands. And they didn't meet till much later, so that was the same pattern to both of them. One was born in Marseille, and the other one was born in Romania. You know, they were very close to me. They were kind of like my Greek parents, so I thought I might read this to you. It's called The Two Flames, and it's part of a longer sequence called What You Told Me About Islands. An island is a place which is an image of identity, it's an image of home, but it can also be a prison. People who are born on Greek islands also have to leave them. You know, there's no work there. They're dying to get away when they're teenagers. So it's very complicated being part of an island.
Okay.
Let's say you found each other like repeating flames in an antique mirror, trailing the memory of two Greek ports in foreign lands where you were born, and two islands you fled back to when the devil began to dance the mad Isropi, and you learned the island song of eterno ritorno. One hot cold summer when you find yourself, then rage to get away, dark winter alcohol, high winds to cut you off, a closed-in grey horizon, and a harbour where all your debts and fantasies are known. While beyond the mountain, one small bay waits on, never not dreamed of, lifelong loved and left. The soul is a wanderer and fugitive, driven by decrees and laws of gods.
Mm-hmm. I love that you read that. That is very apropos of our conversation just previously. Thank you so much, Ruth. It's really been a pleasure. I want to ask you the last question, but before we go, it's really hard to end this because I love hearing you read so much. Would you like to read one more thing before we go?
Okay, yeah. Maybe the opening of the book I published last year, which is a poem about Christmas. I'll read the end of it. It's about sunrise. It's about homelessness and sunrise. It's set in a little church, one of the oldest from the 5th century churches in London, called Old St. Pancras, which was for a martyred boy from Phrygia, very near Syria, he was St. Pancras, and he was martyred in Rome, and his cult spread to Britain. And the Angel of Silence helps around this church, helps an old, a homeless man into a hostel. And as he tracks him through the snow in London through the night, we see the sunrise coming across the globe in a sort of ring of flame, starting in East Australia, and then going over Syria, and then going to Rome, and then finally London, and then it ends up in your neck of the woods. This is called Sunrise on Liberty Island, and it's spoken by the Angel of Silence. Last embers of the sunset turn the stone of old St. Pancras Church to dusky hellebore. In this realm, for now, I'm done. Twilight is here, the day must close, and my voice stop for another year. Robin puts his hand to the hostel door as other doors far away are opening, and the gold wing of Christmas dawn sweeps the Atlantic, glowing on terracotta rooftops of Natal, northeast Brazil, flushing the topmost spires of the tallest buildings in Manhattan. There's someone down in the fading dark and brightening to citron morning light is singing O Little Town of Bethlehem. The sun climbs over Liberty State Park, New York Harbor, and the waterfront until a torque of fretted gold blazes from the sea behind the colossal silhouette of Liberty enlightening the world and sparkles on her torch welcome to immigrants, and her crown of seven sun rays, chosen for seven continents and seven seas, because her maker dreamed that freedom would now be universal. The Christmas sun throws tiny shadows into a kaleidoscope of letters cast in bronze upon her pedestal. Send me your homeless, yearning to breathe free. Let that hope shine on, like the wheel of a rare fire rainbow in a circumhorizontal arc above the sleeping harbor, while I fall silent and you step back into the dark, transforming world where time once more is real.
Oh my gosh, I'm so glad I asked you to read one more, because that was really lovely and such wonderful imagery in there as well. Really.
Thank you.
Just so wonderful. Now, I want to ask you the last question, and I mean, perhaps we should talk a little more about that poem before I just ask you, but you're reading the typical last question. Yeah, that poem did seem to me particularly filled with wonderful imagery and just a gorgeous piece to end this on, but also almost a triumphant tone.
A what tone? Sorry.
Almost such a triumphant tone. It seemed.
I wrote that before Trump's election. I knew that it would, you know, that it was going into a strange, you know, into a horizon of expectations I didn't, you know, an unknown zone. But it's still, I mean, the Statue of Liberty is still a sort of breathtaking monument, a hope, really, of hope of a better world. And I suppose I'm trying, because I've got this image of sunrise coming across the world, and this is this down and out tramp who hasn't spoken for years to anybody. He's got a little tame fox. And the angel of silence is sort of gradually moving him forward through the fox to some sort of contact with people. And I suppose there is this image of Christmas as a place, a time of potential, a lot of disappointments. And in India, it's often a time of violence against Christians. And of course, in other places like Syria as well. So it's dangerous to be a Christian in many countries of the world, which the sun travels over each Christmas morning. But it's also, in its sort of theology and its culture, it's a time of reaching out when you can make contact with the lost, the homeless, the unconnected, if you can open yourself to making contact.
Right,
so that's really what the light is standing for. That's a different sort of phosphorus from Darwin and a different phosphorus from Lucifer. But it's still light bringing in some way or other.
Mm. Ruth, thank you so much. Before we go, I want to ask you what you're reading now. Could be off topic or not, but I'm always curious what...
I've just finished a book which is on a shortlist for the Man Booker, which is called Exit West. It's by Mohsin Hamid. I think it's brilliant. It's about, I mean, because I've spent really a long time thinking about immigration and migration and what does it mean, and animals, people, you know, migration made the world. And he's just dealt with what is happening now so imaginatively, so poignantly.
Ruth, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure listening to your work and talking.
Thank you. Well, I think what you're doing is so interesting, and you know, I look forward to hearing all sorts of other people.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.